From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. President Biden has approved a federal disaster declaration in New Mexico, where there are six major wildfires right now. The largest has burned more than 250 square miles and forced thousands of people to evacuate. The wildfires in New Mexico and surrounding states are just one of the consequences of 20-plus years of drought.
Also this week, the federal government took unprecedented steps on the Colorado River to protect water and power supplies for millions of people who rely on it. The Interior Department said that it will keep more water in Lake Powell instead of sending it downstream to Lake Mead. These two reservoirs are the largest in the country. They're also as low as they have ever been. And what happens to them next will determine the future of cities like Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and Phoenix. This week, I went to Lake Powell on the Utah-Arizona border and asked a man named Ken Runnels to show me just how far it's fallen.
I would say since 2018, it's lost 70 feet.
Is it kind of shocking for you to see that?
Yeah, it's kind of shocking.
Runnels runs the Antelope Point Marina, where golf carts rumble around a floating dock full of million-dollar houseboats. Runnels says he's watched the lake drop about a foot every week. It's hard to understand what that means until you look up at the canyon walls that surround the marina. There's a ramp that used to connect the docks to land. It's dangling above us like a plank on a pirate ship.
It's a cliff. It drops off 50 feet off a cliff.
All this means that getting down to the water is getting more difficult. Last year, Runnels says 7,000 boats launched here from the shore. This year, the water is so low, there won't be any. There's more to see, so we jump into a boat and motor to a nearby public boat launch that's all but closed. Only the bravest kayakers can still use it. They have to scamper down a hillside to get to the water, dragging their kayaks behind them.
It's pretty steep.
Where that truck is up there on the top of the hill, that basically used to be where the water was?
The water was above that. That closed in October of 2020.
Oh, look, and there's somebody coming down right now.
Yeah, so they got to walk that little goat path all the way down. And
we're laughing, but, you know, I mean, it's kind of a big deal. At least, at the very least, it's a big shift of culture on the lake, don't you think?
Yeah, that's a big shift in culture, and it's actually not very safe what they're doing there.
It's not just unsafe. The drought is bad for business. Runnels is worried about canceled houseboat reservations. The local economy depends on this lake. But as we crank the engine and move down the canyon, it's hard not to think about the bigger picture. 40 million people in the West rely on the Colorado River and its reservoirs to survive. Climate change is drying them out. It's sapping the river of its power, while cities and farms drink from the same tap with unslakable thirst. Soon, Runnels has to let off the throttle. We've reached the end of the lake, and we are face to face with a towering concrete wall. What's happening inside the Glen Canyon Dam is a symbol of the mounting crisis.
Dam.
The next day, I'm on a dam elevator with Bob Martin. We're descending below the waterline hundreds of feet to the bottom. It's cold down here.
And it stays this temperature year-round in here because of the water.
Martin is deputy power manager for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the agency responsible for managing water and electricity on the river.
So now we're going into the powerhouse. This is where the generators are at, where the money is made.
Martin shows me a row of huge yellow generators. Below them, water from Lake Powell is spinning turbines to make electricity.
This is clean power. The emissions that we're producing are water that goes to the Southwest.
But with drought, there is less water to do the work. Already, the dam is generating about 30% less electricity than it could be. And if the reservoir drops another 30 feet or so, it'll reach a level called minimum power pool. At that point, the turbines cannot spin at all.
We are as close to that minimum power pool as we have ever been.
What do you think about that?
Not a good thing. Pretty scary. You know, I've been in hydropower for a long time, and our mission has been to keep these units running. That's a pretty sobering thought.
These just turning off
in a powerhouse being quiet. It'd be heartbreaking to hear this place quiet.
And potentially devastating to anyone who needs that power to turn the lights on.
That's a big deal. That's a significant amount of power.
Srinivasa Venigala works for the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. The tribe gets nearly half of its electricity from the Colorado River. Like other utilities across the West, Venigala is preparing for a future with less hydropower. He says as the water drops at Lake Powell, the Navajo Nation will have to use more expensive and dirtier forms of electricity. That's something his 43,000 customers cannot afford.
It's going to be everybody in the Southwest is going to be impacted. Everyone has to bear the burden, in my opinion, if we can't produce any hydroelectricity from the dams on Colorado River.
And that is exactly why the Interior Department announced this week that it would keep more water in Lake Powell instead of sending it downstream to Lake Mead, which faces dire water levels of its own. That sacrifice should be enough to keep the turbines spinning a while longer. Back at the bottom of the Glen Canyon Dam, Bob Martin takes me outside to the transformer deck with a view that would either make you praise God or an engineer. Behind us, the concrete dam soars toward the sky. In front of us, the Colorado River resumes its journey downstream, carving out the blood-red sandstone walls of Glen Canyon.
And that hum you hear is the electricity that's on the overhead lines that's going out to close to 6 million people throughout the West. Pretty impressive.
So now we can really hear the final product here.
You can really hear the final product.
Martin says the government's plan to keep those power lines buzzing should be enough to get through the year. But after that, it's impossible to know.
It's to the point now where people can't ignore this. You've got to pay attention.
And use what we do have wisely, he says. At this point, it is the only thing we can control.
Sobering story, Peter. Water, energy, climate, and great pics you have on our website. Glad you took us on the road.
Yeah, just to see that in person, just absolutely stunning. And of course, we're going to keep a close eye on the drought, on the wildfires, and on the impacts of climate change across the West.
Yeah, great. On the continuing abortion story, Democrats in Congress want to act after the draft Supreme Court opinion that overturns Roe v. Wade leaked on Monday night. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, spoke on Tuesday.
It is our intention for the Senate to hold a vote on legislation to codify the right to an abortion in law.
Now, the political reality is the Democrats do not have the votes to pass this because of the filibuster, which means they would need 60 votes, not just a simple majority. So how does the filibuster work and how might it go away? Answers now from NPR's Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
All right, when I think filibuster, I think of a senator who kind of looks like Jimmy Stewart in the movie talking for 25 hours. But in reality, how does the filibuster stand in the way of a majority in the Senate, say 51 votes?
Well, it is possible that somebody could do that. That's kind of known as a talking filibuster. We've seen that happen from time to time. I'm thinking about Ted Cruz reading Green Eggs and Ham on the Senate floor so many years ago.
Yeah.
But more often, we see the filibuster exercised as the senators just simply not getting enough votes to overcome the 60-vote threshold necessary to overcome to move ahead on a procedural vote. It's called cloture. If they can't get through that, then they can't move on to a final vote. And that happens kind of a lot in the Senate. Pretty much any time that there isn't, you know, huge bipartisan support for a bill, they're unable to get cloture. And so we often will see when whichever party is in control wants to send a message or wants to show that they are trying to do something and they want to point fingers at the other party or even some within their own party who don't agree, they will hold a vote and let it fail on cloture just to prove where the votes actually are.
Yeah, so as you're describing it, any measure with any modicum of controversy, say an abortion bill, would have to have this supermajority. First of all, in this case, is there any way supporters of a new abortion law have 60 votes?
No, not in this case. And, you know, there are a couple of different versions of abortion rights protections that are being discussed. One is something that Democrats are seeking that is a broader protection, codifying Roe versus Wade. And then there is a bill that was proposed by Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Republican Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, also a Republican, that is a more narrow version of protections that basically makes sure that states would not put any undo restrictions on a woman's access to abortion, but it doesn't prevent states from having some restrictions related to health guidelines. That said, neither of those bills is expected to have 60 votes, despite the fact that the two Republican senators say they would like to take a chance on voting on their bill to show whether or not there might be additional support beyond the maybe 53-ish votes that we would anticipate would fall for that.
And quickly, the Senate, it can vote to just end the whole filibuster, right?
Well, there are things that that is something that could be done. And I should say it's not just the whole filibuster that they could do away with. They can take away the filibuster in pieces. There were moves taken during the Obama administration to end the filibuster for judicial nominees. But again, this requires unanimous support from all 50 Democrats. And that just simply doesn't exist right now.
Yeah. Kelsey Snell is NPR's congressional correspondent. Kelsey, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Last year in the pandemic, Congress passed a nearly $2 billion economic rescue plan. Now, some of that went to Black-owned businesses. But is this a model to actually close the race and wealth gap in this country? And how much do federal programs like this actually address systemic injustice? Turns out McDonald's is an interesting case study. In the civil rights movement, the Big Mac company worked with the government to encourage African Americans to buy local Mickey D's franchises. Historian Marcia Chatelain wrote about this in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. Here and now's Tanya Mosley talked to Chatelain for her podcast, Truth Be Told.
The relationship you had with fast food growing up, and McDonald's in particular, it was more than just about food. Some of your foundational cultural experiences actually came through McDonald's.
Absolutely. So McDonald's, I often tell my students, before the age of cell phones, is where we would all kind of gather to get going. So for me, going to a McDonald's was about my adolescence and my independence. But it was also a gateway to learning a lot of Black history. The first time that I read a serious piece of Black history in high school was because the local McDonald's franchise organization, Black Franchisees, had sponsored a quiz bowl called Know Your Heritage. And so I read about the Great Migration. I was learning about, you know, the city of Chicago. And I think years later, when I was training to be a professional historian, I thought that was such a strange entry place. It wasn't that I was learning Black history at school. I was learning it through this program from McDonald's.
Yes. I mean, as part of your research for this book, you asked this question, how did McDonald's, this largely suburban fast food restaurant, become such a mainstay in urban, primarily Black and brown communities? And what you found is that it actually started during the civil rights era and the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, you know, when we think of Dr. King's assassination, we think of the gravitas of the moment and the confusion and the outrage people had over his loss. And I think very few people really understand that this was an entry point for people to start thinking about Black-owned businesses as a solution to the distress that people were experiencing. And so after King's assassination, there was a call for Black capitalism, more Black ownership of businesses, and the McDonald's Corporation seized that moment to start recruiting Black franchise owners in predominantly Black neighborhoods. And so in this really weird way, when we think about all of the visible signs of King's legacy, that entry point is a really important part of it because it's one of those initiatives that has actually lasted longer than some of the more important goals of the period. Fair housing, equalization of access to schools, the end of police brutality. We didn't see that, but what we did see was a corporation aligning itself with this idea of Black capitalism and being very successful at it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've heard you say that you've enjoyed most with the publishing of this book are the memories that people tell you about McDonald's. I've been thinking a lot about this, and I will say one of the most salient memories in my life was wanting to have my fifth birthday party
to
be there.
Yes.
I wanted that so bad.
Yes.
I never got it, by the way. I mean, there is a lot of nostalgia wrapped around our experiences with McDonald's.
Absolutely. And I think that it's important. You know, there is, I think, a segment of the population that says, well, McDonald's is cheap food. It's fast food. It's the food that, you know, poor people eat. So what could be so interesting about it? But, you know, rarely do we have common experiences within our culture that people have an entry point for the idea of it. And I think for, you know, restaurants that are in predominantly Black areas, you know, the presence of a McDonald's is an extension of the influence that the franchisee may have. It may be a marker of the places where people in the community can actually get jobs and not fear job discrimination. You know, it can be all of those things, and it can be problematic, and it can be, you know, a sign of some lack of choices in terms of nutritional diversity in people's diets. It can be all of those things. But I think it's really dangerous to sell it short and to not imagine that something like fast food can be really meaningful to people.
Right. I mean, you also write about this empowerment for Black franchisers, this idea that you could build Black wealth to help communities. I mean, this is a flawed idea. And it also came with a price. Every franchise of McDonald's is not created equal.
Absolutely. I mean, part of what happens in the late 60s and continues into the 70s and 80s is that Black franchisees inherit stores that white franchise owners did not want anymore. They were in neighborhoods that they didn't want to do business in, and they were often managing stores that had shoddy equipment and buildings that had property damage, and the carrying costs of doing business in a lot of those communities were higher. So they're paying higher taxes, higher security costs, higher insurance, and so you start to see this kind of two-tiered system within a system that is supposed to make people a lot of money. And the thing that I think is really poignant is shortly after my book came out, a group of Black franchise owners sued McDonald's. And the claims that they were making were they were being redlined into only Black neighborhoods. And so they had to compete with not only other McDonald's restaurants, but the other fast food brands that have come into those communities, that they weren't getting the support that they needed from McDonald's, and that the system of discrimination that led Black owners to create the National Black McDonald's Operators Association in 1972 was still happening, you know, decades later. And I think that it's a real reminder about the limits of this kind of wealth building to try to mediate racial injustice. Because a lot of people did become very wealthy and very successful as a result of franchising, but it all comes at a cost. And so I think it reminds us that we have to be really vigilant when policy solutions are only geared towards wealth building or business.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about Black liberation and what nourishment means for us, both in the external sense, what we need for community building, and also the more basic understanding of nourishment in the way of the self, like the foods we eat and the media we consume and the messages we internalize. And it has always felt to me that in many ways, McDonald's is this contradiction. It's linked to good memories, as we've been talking about. And it's also seen as junk food and a lack of nourishment. I'm curious how you see it.
You know, I think McDonald's is a mirror of our society's promises and its failures. And especially when you look at the case of what, you know, what people hoped McDonald's would do in Black communities. Give people great jobs. Provide endless opportunity. Provide wealth for reinvestment. And these things cannot be done by a corporation. These things need to be done by communities with support from a robust federal system, is my perspective. So what happens is, you know, there's all of this weight of promise. There's all of this, like, weight that this thing is going to make all the difference in our communities, and it doesn't happen. And so I think the disappointment that Black business didn't liberate people, it didn't give them, you know, that kind of freedom that they were seeking, was not only disappointing, but then it's confusing because so much of the rhetoric, even today, and so many resources go into this idea that Black business is going to fix it all. You know, I find it really poignant that during the George Floyd summer, one of the loudest responses wasn't, you know, an end to police brutality. And it wasn't, you know, better jobs and more opportunities for people to get treatment for drug addiction, it was, you know, buy from Black creators, support Black business. And the idea that Black business would then be weighted to right the wrongs that killed George Floyd is impossible, but it's also, you know, really upsetting to think about. But if you remember, you know, the summer of 2020, that was a lot of the framing. That was a lot of the takeaway. That was a lot of the investment. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, McDonald's may not provide food that can give long-lasting nourishment, but I think that the fast food industry satiates something in us. And I think that it's the desire for there to be easy answers to our social problems.
You view Michael Brown's death and the role of McDonald's in Ferguson as a bookend to 1968. Can you say more about that?
You know, watching Ferguson unfold as someone who spent so many years in Missouri as a student and spent so much time after my life as a student in Missouri, it was affective in so many ways. But one of the things that I thought was really fascinating was the ways that McDonald's in Black America was initiated by racial unrest and chaos, and the ways that McDonald's appears in the background of the continued chaos of our nation's racial unrest. And so watching the Ferguson McDonald's in the background, as reporters were doing stand-ups and as people were organizing, you know, getting a text from a friend that she had been tear gassed and, you know, ran to the McDonald's to see if she could put milk on her face, like seeing that in the background, it made too much sense, because McDonald's in Black neighborhoods were supposed to solve the problem that brought them there. And here we were, you know, nearly five decades after King's assassination, and McDonald's is one of the places that is still able to stand in this moment of unrest. And so, you know, that for me was confirmation that this was the book I needed to write.
That's Marcia Chatelain, Pulitzer Prize winning author of the book franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. For Here and Now, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And they're about to be off. The 148th running of the Kentucky Derby is Saturday. And after 2 years of COVID restrictions, more than 150,000 fans could turn out to watch the race at Churchill Downs. But some people in Louisville say the race is once again opening old wounds. Stephanie Wolf is arts and culture reporter for WFPL. And Stephanie, this is always such a big festive event. How's it feel there in Louisville now that it's back in full force?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an excitement in the air. You know, I go to the grocery store and people wish me happy Derby. I was walking around downtown and they were passing out these chocolate Derby coins. And there's also been all these community events in the weeks leading up to Derby, which have largely been canceled the past 2 years. A parade, wrestling, bed racing, and I've seen really sizable
crowds.
Did you
say bed racing? Really,
bed racing. They take mattresses and make... like kind of like soapbox cars and race them. And there was, you know, it was a very enthusiastic crowd at that event on Monday.
Okay, so enthusiastic crowds. But of course, there are many people in Louisville who also wanted to see some changes to the Derby this year, thought it might be a moment for reset. They've raised concerns about how officials there have responded or not responded to another big story in Louisville. Of course, the police killing of Breonna Taylor back in 2020. You've got some tape from a woman named Casa Heron. Let's listen.
Back in 2020, I remember the protesters coming out here, and I remember feeling like I don't think I'll ever be at the track again. There was just so much divisiveness in the community, and I was very disappointed in the leadership of how Churchill Downs did or did not step in. And so to be back at the backside just kind of feels like, I don't know, I feel weird about it, but it does feel great to be here.
So people are torn. Tell me more about that side of the story. What do people like CASA actually want the Derby organizers to do?
Yeah, it's really a complex situation where people have all this excitement to have the Derby back at full scale again. But yeah, there are memories of 2020 and even previous years where, you know, the Derby's a big moneymaker for Churchill Downs. And some would like to see more of that money actually go back to the community, to the neighborhoods that are right next door to Churchill Downs. Some would like to see Churchill Downs do more to support its backside and service workers. I mean, the Derby wouldn't be possible about them. And there's also been calls in recent years for Churchill Downs to, well, ditch a Derby tradition that some say is rooted in racism, and that's this performance of the controversial state song, My Old Kentucky Home.
Oh, right. And what's the resolution on that this year?
My Old Kentucky Home will be performed. It'll be performed with the University of Louisville's marching band and choir. So that tradition that's been around since about the 1920s, it is back in play this year.
So just briefly, I mean, how does the race officials, how do they respond to all this? How are they feeling about their sense of place in the community?
Yeah, well, last year, Churchill Downs announced a partnership with two other Louisville organizations. They said they would launch a 5-year plan that is known as the Derby Equity and Community Initiative. Officials cited the 2020 protest as a push, and they say that they're going to commit to make a more diverse and inclusive event in the sport of horse racing.
Stephanie Wolf is arts and culture reporter at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. The Kentucky Derby is on Saturday. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
To state the obvious, health insurance in this country is pricey. We're talking $22,000 a year for a family through an employer. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And employees pay about $6,000 of that. Now, some Christian communities have formed alternative groups to pool their money in what are called healthcare sharing ministries. It's cheaper. But at least one of these ministries has gone bankrupt and been liquidated, leaving members stuck with medical bills in the tens of thousands of dollars. We're going to hear from one of them. But first, reporter Luann Huska is covering this for Christianity Today. Luann, hi.
Hi, Scott.
So I understand these healthcare sharing ministries have been around since the 80s. What's the premise? What's the model here?
Yeah, so healthcare sharing ministries are groups that have common religious or ethical values, and they agree to share one another's health expenses by making monthly payments into a pool of money that becomes available whenever members have a qualifying healthcare expense.
Okay, so it sounds kind of like the model for an insurance company, but legally they're exempt. Is that right, from many laws that apply to health insurance companies, like having to cover pre-existing conditions and that kind of thing?
Yes, so healthcare sharing ministries are not regulated as insurance. And so they're not required by law to pay any of their members' expenses. And they also are not regulated under the Affordable Care Act's newer regulations requiring insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. And more mm-hmm. healthcare sharing ministries are popping up across the country.
Luann, you have reported on the collapse of one of these organizations. It was called Charity Ministries and formerly Trinity Health Share. I understand this group only paid out 16 cents for every dollar it took in premium. So tell us about this. How many members did it have? How much does it owe in unpaid bills?
Charity Ministries started offering plans through a for-profit healthcare management company called Alira in 2018. At its highest point, Charity had about 40,000 member households across the country. According to a lawsuit filed by the state of California, Charity denied a majority of claims and spent as little as 16 cents on the dollar. And last year, Charity's board found out that unfulfilled sharing requests were twice what they expected, to the order of about $50 to $60 million. So at that point, they decided to undergo a reorganization bankruptcy. And the plan, according to former board member and president Joe Guarino, was to clean up their financial house and keep helping members pay their healthcare expenses. But in July of 2021, four of the five board members, excluding Guarino, decided to pursue liquidation instead.
All right, so let's bring in Mike Johnson, a former member of Charity. He lives about an hour outside of Chicago. Mike, tell us, why did you join Charity in the first place?
I joined originally to, you know, save some money on healthcare costs. It was really just as simple as that. I was referred by a friend that I trusted, and he's also in the insurance business, and he recommended getting on board. And my wife and I signed up for it to save money, and we did.
And at what point did you and your wife notice something's not quite right here?
Well, we started getting bills from the hospital of claims that were not being processed. So we started to do a little bit of digging, and you know, we found out that they had continued to collect premiums but stopped paying any of the claims as of September of 2020. That just really ruffled my feathers, and this is supposed to be a Christian organization, and to me that was not a very Christian-like way to handle the situation.
And when you dug into it, was there much clarity into what happened?
No, not really. I was really thankful. Luann and I connected, and she actually suggested to me a law firm that had filed some civil suits against Charity based in Delaware. And I connected with them and actually signed up to be part of the civil lawsuit that they are filing, hopefully in Illinois soon.
So, Mike, how much are you on the hook for in unpaid medical bills?
Well, originally it was just shy of $25,000 simply because I had a procedure done, which is a common procedure as we get older, at the hospital. It wasn't, cancer or anything really serious or an existing, condition or anything like that. And that was about $18,000, if I remember correctly. And then the unpaid, hospital doctor visits and follow-ups and stuff like that. It was just shy of $25,000.
Wow.
Which has now been handed over to a collection agency. So I'm having to deal with them as well.
Yeah. And honestly, do you think you'll be made whole here or partially whole?
I'm hoping for partial. I'm trusting that this is going to work out the way that it should work out. It's in God's hands, not mine now. And I just have to trust and let it go. And if it works out, it works out. But I am responsible for that bill. I retired and my wife is down to 3.5 days of work right now. We're trying to, kind of get some traveling in and spend some time with the grandkids. And right now this is, kind of limiting us on some of those expenses.
And let me ask the both of you, first to Luann, what's your takeaway from this story, from this chapter?
Well, consumers, if they're considering getting into a healthcare sharing ministry, I would suggest looking at the state insurance department's websites for any advisories on various ministries that might be sending up red flags, and also looking at Better Business Bureau. Also, some members that have had positive experiences where their healthcare sharing requests have been paid have just told me that it's important for people to do their homework and, see if they know people who have had good experiences going through these ministries and had their claims paid in a timely manner.
Yeah. And Mike Johnson, what about you?
Well, I feel the same way. I think, as a consumer, be careful about saying, to yourself, hey, I'm going to save 50% on my healthcare costs and not pay attention to some of the finer details like Luann just mentioned. Watch out for companies that are not insured and that are not legally bound by insurance company protocol.
Mike, I hear that both of you, saying buyer beware, trust but verify. But these are organizations that appeal to people based on their trust, aren't they?
Absolutely. They played on my trust and they played on my faith. You know, I took them at face value as being a legitimate Christian-based organization, as I'm sure most of its members did. And another thing that kind of frosts my cookie is that they're still in business.
Luann, thoughts?
From what I understand, Charity did liquidate in December of 2021. So I believe that at that point, they stopped taking members and paying out any, accepting any member payments or paying out any healthcare expenses. And that is definitely a dilemma, as you mentioned, Scott, that these ministries are based on the premise that members trust one another and will look out for one another. And I think that model has worked for a lot of people, especially for smaller groups. A lot of these ministries start out as church-based groups, but different actors have come into the picture trying to take that model of trust-based healthcare sharing and use it to their advantage. So that is where things have gotten really tricky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's reporter Luann Huska, who has covered the now bankrupt healthcare sharing ministry, Charity, for Christianity Today. And Mike Johnson is a former member of Charity who has been left with more than $10,000 in medical debt. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Monday is Victory Day in Russia. It's a holiday marking the Russian defeat of Nazi Germany at the end of World War II in Europe. Typically, it's celebrated with an elaborate military parade in Moscow's Red Square. Western officials believe that this year, Russian President Vladimir Putin may use Victory Day to officially declare war on Ukraine, or he could try to demonstrate some success in this invasion. Faith Hillis is a professor of Russian history at the University of Chicago, and she joins us now. Faith, welcome.
Hello, good to be with you.
Can I first ask you to give us a little history on the origins of Victory Day and how much this matters to Russian identity?
So Victory Day is a day that celebrates the end of the Second World War. Of course, the Second World War in Europe, the armistice was signed on May 8th, 1945, but it was already after midnight in Moscow, so therefore Russia celebrates it a day later on May 9th. Mm. There was a large parade in Moscow in 1945 celebrating the end of the war, but one of the really interesting things about Victory Day in Russia is that then for 20 years, it wasn't actually much of a holiday at all. There were no parades, no real celebrations. And it was only in 1965 that it was reinstituted at a time called the Thaw, when I think a lot of Soviet leaders believed that society was beginning to fray. There were questions of how to mobilize youth. And at that point, you began to get the memory of the Second World War, this horrific, painful, but also heroic moment, becoming a cult in Soviet history. And from 1965 on, you see every year lavish military parades, celebrations, and it became what it still remains today.
And what have we learned about how important this day is for Vladimir Putin? I mean, he has talked in this war about Russia is falsely fighting Nazis in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. This holiday is very important for Putin. He's always used it as a day of national celebration, but also as a day to rally Russians against enemies. And I think that that dual feature is even more important than ever this year. He needs to rally Russians behind a war for which there are some signs that there may be flagging support for it as it wears on, as economic hardships due to sanctions compound themselves. And then, of course, there is also this very explosive issue of fascism or Nazism. The struggle against it is part of Russian identity. And that's certainly something that he's also going to try to mobilize this year.
So what are the options, at least from the perspective of Kremlinologists, of what Vladimir Putin might do? Might he dial up the propaganda? Might he declare victory in eastern Ukraine or perhaps amp up the invasion? What are the possibilities?
I think the thing we can be certain that is going to happen is there is going to be some kind of victory declared. Victory Day is, after all, a day of victories, right? There can't be the holiday without a victory. What that victory is for Putin at this time, of course, is subject to interpretation, since it's very hard to look at anything happening in Ukraine as a victory. But certainly he's going to spin that. There's also a lot of speculation that he may actually formally declare a war against Ukraine, which he has not yet done. There's some speculation that he may declare a general military mobilization as well, which would allow National Guards troops and others to be called up, not just conscripts. So those are things that people are talking about.
I wonder what your sense is in the run-up to Victory Day for the Russian people. I mean, NATO estimates that up to 15,000 Russian troops have been killed in this Ukraine war.
Right. I think that's the main challenge that Putin has right now, to translate this as a victory to the Russian people. And as more people die, and as there's an ambiguous victory or, you know, some kind of quagmire that's still going on, I think that's the task he has in front of him right now, to convince people that there truly is a victory, that there is a reason to keep fighting this war, and to try to remind Russians of what he thinks, at least, they should be fighting for.
Faith Hillis, what has stood out to you as someone who studied modern Russian history and politics and culture as you've watched the Russian invasion and war in Ukraine?
On the one hand, I think people who know about history think that this is unprecedented, right? People have been genuinely shocked by the decision to launch a full-scale invasion, and then, of course, the lack of success of that invasion. On the other hand, I think I would say something that I've been struck by is a kind of deep patterning that may ultimately not bode well for this experiment. And one example that I'll give you is, in the last week, Putin announced that he personally is taking over military command of the Ukraine expedition. And this immediately brought to mind what happened in the First World War, when the last Tsar Nicholas II, when things got bad, he said, "I'm going to the front and I'm going to personally command the military." Here's a man who has no military experience and no strategic doctrine or training, and he didn't do well. So I also have to say that when I see Putin getting dug in further and further and investing more and more interest in this, I think it also reminds us how potentially undermining this whole experiment is.
Faith Hillis is professor of Russian history at the University of Chicago. Faith, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.